Coal Wars, in the mines and in the streets.
The events of the mine wars were sparked off by what's referred to as the Matewan Massacre.
That's poet Diane Gilliam Fisher. We talked to her about her book, Kettle Bottom. It's about the mine wars of the 1920s and the people who fought them.
We turn on the TV, we're watching the Super Bowl, and we see a clean coal ad, and we decide, oh, the coal industry is all powerful. Well, they wouldn't be running those ads if they weren't a little bit worried.
And that's Ted Nace. We'll talk to him about the movement to stop new coal plants from being built. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice, right here on this station and on writersvoice.net. The Massey Energy Company mine disaster in West Virginia is but the latest in a long and bitter history of the exploitation of the people and the land of Appalachia's coal country. The other side of that story is how the miners fought back to win better wages and working conditions by organizing the United Mine Workers Union. Looking at the Upper Big Branch mine, one fact stands out for those who know how important that union history is. Massey's mine was non-union. Far more coal mine fatalities happen in non-union mines than those where workers are unionized. Poet Diane Gilliam Fisher's 2004 book, Kettle Bottom, uses verse to tell the story of the West Virginia mine wars of 1920 to 21. That's when the United Mine Workers Union went up against the coal operators and their hired thugs. Many people died, mostly miners, and President Harding sent in troops to quell the rebellion. The southern coal fields didn't win union recognition until 1933. Fisher's own family is from the Kentucky side of the region, just across the border from West Virginia. I asked her to tell us about the title, Kettle Bottom.
A kettle bottom is a miner's term. It's a petrified tree trunk that's buried in the mountain, because remember, we said the mountains are ancient. And if you circled your arms, about that size of a kettle bottom could weigh 200 or 300 pounds. And because they're petrified wood and not mineral, nothing in the mountain binds to them. So when the miners tunnel through, if they remove enough of what's supporting them, those kettle bottoms just drop through the roof and they would crush whoever was underneath. So it's one of the things that the miners are most afraid of. And it still happens. I Googled kettle bottom the other day and I found a judgment about a 1998 death of a man from a kettle bottom.
Kettle Bottom is Diane Gilliam Fisher's second book of poetry. She says her first book, One of Everything, was very different.
It's a book written pretty directly from autobiography, understanding autobiography not only as my life, but my mother's life and my grandmother's and my daughter's life. So that book sort of tells the story of four generations of women in my family. Coming from an Appalachian background, I had a lot that was given to me, and oftentimes as I was writing that first book, it seemed that I only had to listen to get poems. My mother began to tell me stories of the way her life had been when she was growing up, and I would only have to shape a little bit what she told me and have a poem on the page, which is a wonderful thing, but in a sense, it's a mixed blessing.
Why is that?
It was wonderful, but in a sense not completely satisfying. I felt there was something I needed to do still to grow as a writer. So I began to sort of actively look for models. And the most direct model and inspiration for Kettle Bottom was Ellen Bryant Voigt's book, Kyrie, which is a collection of sonnets about the 1918 flu epidemic. So I listened, I had a tape of that book, and I was listening to it in the car one day, and I thought, what is it exactly that she's done? She's taken a piece of history that most people have forgotten about, and through multiple personas has imagined all these points of entry into what this experience was like to live in this time that was so dangerous. I thought, maybe I could try that. I had just turned back to begin to find out about the place and the people that I came from, so I knew a little bit about the mine wars. I knew I had access to this language because it was the language that was spoken in my home. So I thought I could try it.
Could you say a little bit about your family's history and also a little bit more about the history that you talk about in your poetry?
Well, my father's from eastern Kentucky around Paintsville. My mother was born in Mingo County, which is where a lot of the events of the mine wars took place. And my grandfather was a young man working in the mines at the time of the mine wars. The events of the mine wars were sparked off by what's referred to as the Matewan Massacre. What happened there was that Stone Mountain Coal was the company in the county at that time, and they had sent Baldwin Felt's agents, who were the private police gun thugs that policed the coal camps, to set some people out of their house because they were suspected of union activity. Well, Sid Hatfield was the mayor of Matewan at the time, and he stopped them from putting the people out. But the Baldwin Felts came back the next day with reinforcements, and there was a gun battle. I think 7 Baldwin Felts agents were killed, including 2 brothers of Thomas Felts, who was the head of the agency, and a couple miners and the mayor of Matewan were killed. After that, it was basically a situation of guerrilla warfare between the miners and the Baldwin Felts, who were policing for the company. So martial law was declared in Matewan, but only for the miners, not for everyone else.
And why did you want to choose this particular period of the history of where your family had come from?
One of the things that I'm really interested in is the choices that people make. So this was a time where it was very, very dangerous to be in this place. I mean, dangerous like shooting in the streets, dangerous. And yet, many of the people that lived through that time chose to stay together and build community. People counted on each other in that time in a way that I think would be good to have now.
You have a poem in which, well, I suppose a lot of your poems probably deal with that issue of choice. I wonder if you could read that for us now. Tell
sure.
us what that is.
This poem is called Milk. The woman who gives the milk in the poem, her name is Marie Ash. She's my friend Leona's mother. Milk. Mama always said, you can't feed a baby if there's no happiness in the milk. Now, we didn't judge a man by what he had, but by whether he took his pay home before he went to the bar, and Burns Cantrell did not. And he hit Mary, which wasn't no fault of hers, Mama said. So when she had a baby come in strike time, Mama bought 2 tins of canned milk out of the dollar a week the company store allowed each family for food, and sent me to set them on Cantrell's porch every Monday after Burns had went up the hill. Now, it was the law among the miners that come a roof fall, you run. Everybody knowed that was how it was. If you stop and look back to see who's dead or trapped, you only make more dead. 4 days after the men went back in, there come a bad roof fall, killed 16. Daddy was back behind. Right off, the rocks broke 1 backbone and his jaw in 5 places. Burns Cantrell was up front. He heard them rocks begin to fall, and he run back into the hole, pitch black, the mountain crumbling like the end of the world, and carried Daddy out. He knowed he owed my mama for the milk.
You know, I was really struck by that poem because the way it begins, there's certainly a sense that this is not a sympathetic character. You're talking about someone who beats his wife, who's alcoholic, and yet at the end he risks his life to save the life of a man who he's recognized has taken care of his family in some way. And I wonder if you could talk about this kind of moral, I don't want to call it ambiguity, because I think it's more showing the whole person how people are capable of both good and ill, and why you wanted to make this poem, why you told this story.
Well, because there's a choice that gets made in this poem that seems to me so important. And I think for a long time, we didn't have to be very careful with our choices here in this place and time. But since September 11th, we don't feel as safe as we felt anymore. And we have to learn to be more careful with our choices now than we have been before. The woman in this poem who gave the milk, she had so much to be afraid of. I mean, I don't care if it's 1920. To know you have to feed your family on a dollar a week and you don't know how long that's going to go on is a pretty frightening prospect. And yet this woman chose to make community. She gave the milk, and I'm sure the baby's life was saved because of what she did. But also, her husband's life was saved because of what she did. And even this man who drank and hit his wife had a moment of grace because he was let to be the vehicle for that community to happen. He was let to have a moment where he could be something larger than what he was.
What do you feel is a lesson that we should take away from that? What is the connection with the choices that we confront right now?
That it's a time for us to be together and to find new ways to be together. That we've been brought up to measure success, for example, in terms of competition. You're successful to the degree that you leave other people behind. You're successful to the degree that you stand out from the crowd, instead of being successful in because of how many people you bring together or who you bring along with you to whatever level of success that you reach, whatever good things happen to you. There's always someone that you can bring along. When I think of the people in this book, especially Marie, this is what I think of, that these are people for us to look to now in a time when we're needing to redefine ourselves.
This is Writer's Voice, and you're hearing an interview I did with poet Diane Gilliam Fisher in 2004 about her book, Kettle Bottom. It's about the West Virginia mine wars of 1920 to 1921 and the people of the region during that time. I was struck in reading the book, Kettle Bottom, of all the different voices and how distinct each voice was and how there was the real sense of the real human beings that was coming through there. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about how you knew how to express these voices. I mean, you have Italian immigrants who were also among the miners and the mining families, very, very different voice. You have a voice of a teacher, which I almost felt was your voice, was the poet's voice.
I did a lot of research to try and understand what the large historical movements were that had brought these people to this place and this situation. So as I did the research, I found out about the diversity of the population in the camps, for example. I read about the position, you know, the philosophies that the companies had that justified what they did. Once the research was underway, the voices began to come to me almost in a mystical way. I need to say that because it's true, but I also want to emphasize the research part. The research and the work and the understanding opens the path for the other thing to happen, I think. And when I read, I feel very much occupied by those voices. I also feel extended by those voices. We were talking about autobiography in the beginning. I feel that in many ways, Kettle Bottom is also autobiographical, but maybe in a deeper, wider, more communal way.
Could you say more about that?
Yeah, I think that I've heard oftentimes people say poets have obsessions. I think my obsession is with danger. and the choices that people make when they live in danger. My mother and my grandmother, my grandfather was very violent. So my mother and my grandmother lived very dangerous lives. All my aunts and uncles too. They didn't all survive as well as my mother did, but my mother and my grandmother kept with love in spite of the things that happened to them. So I have wanted to understand how that happens. So I think at underneath Kettle Bottom is that same question for me, how to live when you have a lot to be afraid of.
So you're saying that this is autobiographical in the sense that it is grappling with some of the core questions of your own life and your own family.
That's right.
And what do you feel that you've learned personally through this process of research and of writing these poems and of channeling these voices of people who confronted that danger? Have you learned any things that directly impact your own life right now?
I've learned that we're not nearly as single and solitary and impermeable as we've been led to believe, which means also that we're not as alone. We don't need to feel as alone as we sometimes feel. So now when I think of myself, I see the whole chain of people behind me. And when I think of the Kettle Bottom people, I think these are the people that I come from. This is the place. These are the people that I come from. This explains something to me about who I am, how I act sometimes, what I think about things.
One of the things that fascinates me is the way in which time is like a palimpsest, or history is like a palimpsest, and you can see the layers of both what has gone on before in a larger sense of time with different people back centuries, but also how your own life overlays that. And I wonder if that's some of what you feel as well.
Yeah, it is, because, and I can maybe point to another reason for that, which is the official story has been told, but I'm interested mainly in seeing how the big story affects people in their most intimate lives. And that's something that maybe doesn't change so much over time. So when somebody, for example, says a bad word to Pearly, one of the characters, on the street in the coal camp, and she doesn't even know what it means, I bet there's not a girl in the world that hasn't had that experience.
I wonder if you could read that poem for us.
Sure. Pearly is about 14. Pearly asks her mama what poontang means. Mama says to don't tell daddy, for he would have to go after them men that spoke to me that way, and God only knows what would happen then. But I would not never want daddy to know. And I did not even tell mama how the one run up behind me laughing and lifted up the back of my skirt with a shotgun. Mama says to don't walk by the store no more, nor go anywhere at all without her, and I promised. But I am going to the store one more time. I have not never stole nothing, nor hardly ever even told a lie, but I have got to get me a knife. All my life I have tried so hard to be so good, and now it is all for naught, for them men has put murder in my heart.
Why did you write this poem?
I had murder in my heart. Someone had done something to someone that I loved, and at this point in time, when I was writing these poems, everything that came to me, I sort of filtered through this other world. And so that came through Pearly. But also because this first line came to me very clearly in her voice. Mama said to don't tell daddy, and it just was there, and I knew I had to follow it through and see what happened to her.
I wonder also if you could say something about the Journal of Catherine Terry. Who is this person? Was she a real person? Was this a real diary that you are drawing your poems from?
No, she's imagined.
And is she a kind of stand-in for you, for the narrator, as a poet?
Maybe in a sense she is. As I was beginning to write her poems, I elaborated for myself a kind of a backstory for her. She's the company teacher. The company would come in the build the camp, they would build the school and bring in the teacher. And she doesn't know everything that she needs to know to teach these children, but her heart is in the right place. So in my imagination, her parents are from the region. They left it to give her more choices, and so then what does she do? She comes right back where they started from. So for me, she's sort of inside and outside at the same time, which is in a sense where I am.
And she's really not trusted by the miners. There's a whole dynamic of tension once the miners go out on strike in their attitude towards her, which comes out in a poem that is made up of a number of shorter poems of what the children say. And the children become then mouthpieces, in some sense, for their fathers.
Mm-hmm.
Is there one of them that you might read?
Sure. How about Edith May? Mm. I'm especially fond of Edith May. She's 9, and she's in 4th grade, and her father is a very proud man, which is a characteristic of Appalachian culture in general. People are proud. They'll give you whatever they have, but not ask for even things that they're entitled to, oftentimes. So Edith May's daddy is like that. So Miss Terry has given them an assignment, What History Means to Me. And this is Edith May's paper. Edith May Chapman, grade 4. I ain't to do this assignment, Daddy says, even if it means I can't come back to school, which I hope it don't. For when we was farming, I could not come many days. And now that we are at Winco, Mama and Daddy has said go ahead and go. But now Daddy has got all mad and stomping around, which makes you wish you was somewhere else, and makes Mama say, now, John. For Daddy is also swearing, and he says I must write this down exactly and not one word more. There ain't no company teacher got nothing to teach us children about history.
You're hearing a 2004 interview Diane Gilliam Fisher gave to Writer's Voice about her book Kettle Bottom. Did you find evidence of that in the research that you were doing, in that kind of tension between the miners and the school teachers, even the churches?
Maybe not the school teachers in particular, but even today in Appalachia, there's tension between inside and outside. If you're inside, you know that everybody else is an outsider. And so here, it's not only that inside-outside thing, but the teacher stands for the company also.
I lived in West Virginia for 4 years, and at the time that I was there, I'd say the folks there had a clearer class consciousness than almost any other people, working people that I had met.
That's right. And that's one reason I wanted this to be in here, because one of the stereotypes that's often directed at people in Appalachia is that they're the people that history left behind, that they're somehow innocent and unspoiled by history, and they're the people who have been maybe, I shouldn't say most, but they are among the people in our country who have been most brutalized by large historical processes like industrialization. They know, you know, it's been done to them enough. They know what's what.
And it continues to be done to them now. Is that right? I mean, the mining, if anything, is even more devastating at this point to the landscape. I mean, there are fewer miners because it's much more automated. But, you know, mountains are being completely eliminated.
Yes. We lost our last home place in West Virginia a couple years back. Actually, it was to a freeway. It wasn't to a mine. But, yes, people's homes are just taken. And there isn't too much people can really do about it. So there's a lot of bitterness for that. There's a lot of work to try and protect the landscape. The mountains are ancient. The number I hear most often is 250 million years old. And you can go put your hand on something that's 250 million years old, and I don't think you should bulldoze it. On the other hand, it's complicated because people need to work. A woman came up to me after reading a couple weeks ago, and she was very tense. She said, "My husband's a strip miner." She said, "He needs 3 more years to get his pension. You know, I don't want the mountains to go down, but people are important too." And I think probably what needs to happen, although I can't begin to imagine the ways and means, is that people in power need to begin to think in terms of places, of landscape and people and a whole organic totality of place, and begin to help places.
There's another poem that you mentioned that you like to read, and that is "Dear Mr. President."
Okay. This is a poem written in the voice of a World War I veteran, and it's written from the Battle of Blair Mountain. In the midst of the labor conflict and the guerrilla warfare that was going on, Sid Hatfield had been called to McDowell County to be tried or to face certain charges with regard to the Matewan massacre. He and another man, they were shot down by Baldwin Felt's agents on the steps of the McDowell County Courthouse, and no one was ever held responsible for that. When the word got out that they had assassinated Sid Hatfield, miners began to just spontaneously converge south of Charleston to march to Mingo County to free the remaining miners who were jailed there without process. And the guerrilla warfare really reached a peak, and it's what's known as the Battle of Blair Mountain. So this veteran is writing to the president from the Battle of Blair Mountain. "Dear Mr. President, you do not know me, although according to Sergeant Platt, you were my commander-in-chief when I served in France, 1916 to 1917. I was not but 19 when I went to the Great War. But when Sergeant Platt said, 'Stand your ground, men,' I stood it. Even when the planes come with gas, and I seen them without masks melt down from the inside, screaming like their lungs was a spider web lit on fire. Then I come back here to West Virginia, to the coal mines. I have seen a whole trip car of men drugged by a mule through a pocket of black damp, which is carbon dioxide, if you don't know, the men all lop-headed and limp-armed, same trickle of blood out the corner of their mouth as them boys in France. Now I look up out of my tent, which Al Burgess has let us strikers set on his place, and again I see planes of the United States of America waiting for your order to drop their gas on the coal miners of West Virginia. A lot of us down here has been to the war, and all of us has been in the mines. You can kill us, Mr. President. We all know that. But what in the world makes you think you can scare us?"
Diane Gilliam Fisher, I want to thank you very much for speaking today and reading us some of your poetry on Writer's Voice.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
Kettlebottom won the 2004 Perugia Press Award and was listed in the 2005 Top 10 Books of Poetry by the American Booksellers Association.
"Some blues are just blues, mine are the miner's blues. Some blues are just blues, mine are the miner's blues. These
Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Coal is the most carbon-intensive of fuels. With climate chaos happening at a faster pace than even the most pessimistic scientists predicted, many are saying we should just leave the coal in the hole. Ted Nace is one of them. His new book, Climate Hope on the Front Lines of the Fight Against Coal, tells the remarkable story of the movement to stop the building of any new coal power plants in the U.S. Remarkable because in just 2 years, between 2007 and 2009, it managed to stop nearly 100 coal power plants from being built, out of 151 proposed. The loosely organized grassroots movement brought a burgeoning coal boom largely to a halt. Ted Nace is the founder of Coal Swarm, a web-based wiki that currently has over 2,000 articles and has become an online hub for the anti-coal movement. Ted Nace, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Oh, it's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
This was one of the few optimistic accounts of the movement to tackle climate change that I've read, so it was a joy to read Climate Hope. Your book is taken up with talking about the fight to end plans to build some 151 new coal plants. How did you get involved in this struggle?
Well, I grew up in a coal mining area in southwestern North Dakota. And when I was in school, I would work in the summers near drag lines and see the operations. And I got real concerned in high school when, you know, when they were going to strip mine one of my favorite places. Then I got out of school and I became a community organizer in North Dakota working on coal issues. And so I've been doing this for a long time, although within that time, I've also taken time off to become a business person and do other things. But I got really back into it 2 years ago when these plans for the 151 coal plants became public. And I was just curious as a journalist about what was going on around the country. I started calling people I knew and, researching it. And as I got into the issue, I realized that the story that I was reading in the papers was just really the tip of the iceberg. There was a lot going on, and it had become a movement across the country that was really comparable to what happened around nuclear power about 20 years ago. So I really wanted to tell the story, and I got to be part of the story as it unfolded.
You open up your book, Climate Hope, on the Front Lines of the Fight Against Coal, with a demonstration in West Virginia in 2009, where climatologist Dr. James Hansen gets arrested. Tell us what's going on there.
Well, this is one of many places around the country in what, you know, people call the red states, supposedly bastions of conservatism. You know, as soon as you get below the surface, you find out that America isn't so simple. Well, West Virginia is a prime example where people who've lived in these valleys for hundreds of years, families in, 8, 9, 10 generations of people have lived in these areas that are now threatened with strip mining. They just simply don't have the numbers to fight the coal companies, so they've invited people from other parts of the country to come and struggle, side by side with them. And one person who took up the call and came to West Virginia was Dr. James Hansen, who's the head researcher, the head of climate research for NASA, works out of New York City. Also one of the first people to identify the problem of global warming back in the 1970s and 1980s and to bring it to Congress. Well, anyway, Hansen has seen the problem get worse and worse and worse. The research is not pointing in a good direction. And he found that as a scientist, he could lay out the prescription, but the policy to deal with the problem just wasn't happening. And he finally came to the conclusion he was going to have to become active as a public citizen, sort of in the model of other scientists who become public figures. You could think of Noam Chomsky or even Albert Einstein as people who spoke out when they felt they needed to, who were basically scientists. Well, Hansen was calling on young people to commit civil disobedience. And then I think he finally came to the conclusion that if he was going to ask other people to do that, he was going to have to put himself on the line. And he went to West Virginia last summer, and he was arrested in June, blockading the entrance to a mountaintop removal site.
And we spoke with Dr. Hansen here, and he told us, and you talk about this also in the book, that if we just get rid of coal, we could actually slow down climate change enough to buy enough time to tackle the problem for real. What are some of the reasons that he says this?
Well, the big factor is just the sheer quantity of coal in the ground. I mean, it just swamps what's left of oil and gas. I mean, there's plenty of oil and gas left to, you know, fuel society for, you know, a significant amount of time, but coal really shadows over that, so that they've actually, you know, researched the climate impact of just burning up what's left of the oil and gas, and it just doesn't look like there's enough of that to really send the climate into, you know, the sort of climate tailspin that scientists worry about. So this is convenient in terms of policy because it's also harder to control oil and gas. They're so easily pumped. They're not in the United States. They're burned in hundreds of millions of vehicles and homes, whereas coal is burned much more centrally. There's only about 600 big power plants in the country. So you can imagine replacing 600 sources of energy. And in fact, we have the technology to do that. The other thing about coal is that the United States has such a large proportion of the international resources that if we can control it in the United States, we have a good shot of really dealing with the climate problem. So you've got this sort of marriage of the necessity of dealing with coal, but also the opportunity to deal with coal. So strategically, it's a very good target. And, you know, this success in the movement in going after and stopping these 151 coal plants, I mean, right now, out of those 151, 97 are no longer on track. Now, that's incredible in less than 3 years. And with that kind of success, you know, you have to be a little bit optimistic because the deadline that the climate scientists have said that this has to be dealt with is 2030. And, you know, the movement really engaged with these plants only 3 years ago.
One objection people have with alternatives to coal, like wind and solar, is getting energy when the wind isn't blowing or the sun isn't shining. I asked Ted Nace to comment.
Right now, we have technologies available to fill the gap. Now, this intermittency problem that people talk about with solar and with wind, there's a couple of answers to that. One is that none of these power sources, when you're talking about solar and wind, are a big central station. They're distributed over you know, a lot of land, and they have sort of a statistical variation among them. The wind tends to blow at night. The sun tends to shine during the day. If you have offshore wind, like off the eastern seaboard, that's some of the most steady wind. But the big answer is that when you have all these things integrated into an electrical system, then the electrical system becomes a way of blending all the different individual sources. And you actually have a more secure electrical system when you have thousands of sources of power rather than just a few very large ones, you know, where you could have one go down. Like, you know, for example, here in California, if one big nuclear power station unexpectedly goes down, you know, we have to fill the gap. There's always going to be the generators that exist now, the natural gas generators that can kick in an instant. So, and then there's a little bit more down the road. There's another way of backing up the intermittency, which is that as the vehicle fleet becomes electric, then car batteries become actually a source of backup during the night. And they're now building solar thermal plants in Spain that have these large underground pressurized hot water sort of thermoses so that they don't just produce electricity during the time of sunshine. They actually go another 7 or 8 hours into the evening, or even 24/7.
And that's solar thermal.
That's solar thermal, right.
How about cost then? You actually say in your book, Ted Nace, Climate Hope, you say that the cost of wind power is actually getting less than the cost of coal. Is that really true?
The cost of new wind is cheaper than the cost of new coal plants. The cost of old existing running coal plants is cheaper than anything because they're already built, they're already paid for. Over half of them were built before 1966. You know, they were long since paid off. And the only cost of running them is just the coal to shovel into the boilers. Those plants are almost impossible to beat economically, just on sheer price of running them. If you actually look at the cost to society, we're paying for every 3 cents worth of electricity we're getting out of them, we're paying 3 cents in the public health system. You know, 23 to 24,000 people die early because of inhaling particulates from coal-fired power plants, and each of those people loses an average of 14 years of life. you know, there's hundreds of thousands of asthma attacks, heart attacks, et cetera, et cetera. If we really count the costs of coal to society, then alternative energy sources are even more of a bargain. And then there's one source of power that's as large as coal that's actually cheaper that nobody ever really thinks about, which is simple efficiency improvements. Right now, California uses about 40% less electricity per person than the average of the United States. California looks a little bit more like a European country in its energy efficiency, and that's just the product of a little bit better building standards, appliance standards, et cetera. That 40% is about as much as coal contributes to the electrical system, 45%. So we just have to make up. If we could just get the rest of the country to be as efficient as California, then we just have to fill 5% more. Now, imagining that happening over the next 20 years, I don't think it's that crazy of a proposition. We could lower our electrical demand by 40% if we brought the rest of the country to the same efficiency that California already has. You know, there's not really a lower standard of living in Germany than in the United States, but they also use 40 or 50% less.
One could argue their standard of living is actually higher.
You could, and, you know, many of the things that make you more energy efficient also make you more comfortable, you know, and also just make things work better. So, absolutely, it's just far and away the most cost-effective way to deal with the energy problem.
Now, the coal industry says that if we don't build more coal plants, we'll have rolling blackouts and the lights will go out. What's your answer to them?
I don't think that's really a danger, and I don't think they would say that right now because there really aren't any more coal plants on the drawing board. This movement to stop new coal plants has really succeeded. There were plants in the pipeline, but last year they didn't start a single new coal plant. The energy industry, the electrical utilities, have kind of given up on building more coal plants. They're back to looking at, say, natural gas, but they're also just converting coal plants into using natural gas or into using biomass. And they built something like 39 gigawatts of wind in the last 7 years or so. And half of that was just in the last 2 years. I mean, the electrical industry itself is changing. The big question is, can we do this fast enough to get to this 2030 deadline? So no, I don't think the electrical industry is saying those kind of things now. And there's a new generation of electrical engineers that's very pro-wind, pro-solar. They see it as a challenge. Really, the electrical industry, a lot of those companies are leaving the political coalitions that have supported coal. You know, some of them are still definitely inside. But more and more, I see the coal industry as being a little bit more politically isolated. You don't get that picture from reading the New York Times. And it's not what you're going to see on Capitol Hill, because the coal industry still has very strong ties to enough senators in key states that they can keep things, you know, running in their, you know, their way. But overall, you know, I get back to the, if you really look at the facts rather than reading the spin or reading the clean coal, you know, media hype, you have to be a little bit optimistic. Things aren't going that badly.
Even if we do succeed in the United States, and as you point out, we have huge coal reserves here, and it would take a big bite out of the use of coal in worldwide. But what about China? In your book, you quote a projection saying that China's production of coal will go up to about 120 billion tons around 2100. And you could argue, and I think it has been argued by people like Bill McKibben, that we just have to keep this stuff in the ground. We can't be burning any more of it. So how is China going to come along on this?
This is often used as a sort of disabling argument against people working on climate change in the United States. They say, well, you could stop coal in the United States, but look at China. They're building one or two power plants every week. Really, the answer to that is to look at what China has in terms of coal reserves. They have about 13% of the world's supply, or even less. They have about as much coal as Montana, which just gives you an indication of how much, just amazing amounts of coal we have here in the United States. Now, not to be a Pollyanna, you have to be concerned about China. I mean, they burned 2.4 billion tons of coal last year, which was more than twice as much as the United States. You know, they burn less oil and gas, but they burn a lot of coal, and coal is the most carbon-intense fuel. So you have to be concerned about China. But ultimately, China does not have the capability to send the world into this, you know, this sort of death spiral type of climate change. And pointing to China as the big problem doesn't make sense, because they're just going to run out of coal before they're able to do that. You know, if you only have as much coal as Montana and you're running at this huge pace, means you're going to have to import coal. And the only places that China can import coal from is Australia, which can only supply about a sixth of China, less than an eighth of China's needs, or the former Soviet Union, and they just don't have the infrastructure in place. So there's a scenario where China just maintains itself as a coal-based economy, but there's another scenario that's unfolding where China is moving quickly sort of through the coal era into the post-coal era. They are very attuned in China to alternative energy, and they've already become the world's leading supplier of wind turbines, for example. So they're moving at hyperspeed into renewable energy. And I think the real danger is that the United States won't take advantage of the strategic opportunity economically, and that we're going to be left behind. We're going to be left behind, sitting here with 600 aging coal plants and not even doing the basic things that we could to replace those. And, China may end up, instead of being an excuse for us doing nothing, they may end up being an example of what we should have done.
We're talking with Ted Nace. His book is Climate Hope on the Front Lines of the Fight Against Coal. Your book, Climate Hope, talks about the fight to end the plans to build those 151 coal plants, and almost all of them are now off the drawing board. The odds seemed really long at the beginning of this, but it by and large, it succeeded. How did that fight happen, and in such short time, make such great strides? What was the kind of organizing that actually helped it to win?
Well, we call it the death of 1,000 cuts. And what that means is that if you look at it from the perspective of someone trying to build a multi-billion-dollar project, they need to have the confidence of bankers. They need to have regulators sign all the appropriate permits. They need to get land. They need to have a utilities regulatory commission decide that the need is there for the power. They need all these things to fall in place, so they basically need a supportive business environment. So what the anti-coal activists do is they start to rain on that parade in all kinds of ways. They interfere with the financing by, things like having people send in their, do bank boycotts and try to alter the lending policies of big banks. They get the business community to think twice about rising electrical rates. They ask questions about whether this is the cheapest option. They go to the state regulators. They do direct action to sort of change the political climate so that regulators feel a little bit more public support for taking bold, for interpreting statutes more strictly. And so all those things, if you look at any one of those things and you see the number of people involved, you say, that sort of organizing couldn't possibly stop a $2 billion coal plant. But when you look at the medley of things happening and you look at it from the perspective of the developers, you realize why it's worked so many times. And a lot of times they use lawsuits. They'll find that a plant can't be built in a certain place or that it can't be built using a certain technology, and they have to go back to the drawing board, say, to put in better sulfur scrubbers or something like that. So, it's sort of a guerrilla war. It's all legal, except the deliberate use of, symbolic nonviolent civil disobedience. But basically, we call it the War of 1,000 Cuts.
It's very interesting to read your own kind of mental process, because a lot of these tactics are demonstrations, street demonstrations included, and including the one that you opened the book with Dr. Jim Hansen. Sometimes there's only, maybe 50 to 100 people there.
Yeah, and you feel like a fool for being there. Why do I have this, why am I sitting here with this sign? People are walking by ignoring me. It takes a little bit of a leap of faith to be involved in a movement like this, especially when, you don't read about it in the papers. And your only evidence that a lot of people around the country care is that you're reading, messages from each other online. I think one of the worst things about activism in the United States is the way we relate to the country as a whole, which is generally through the media rather than by getting out there and talking to ordinary people. So we turn on the TV, we're watching the Super Bowl, and we see a clean coal ad, and we decide, the coal industry is all-powerful. Well, they wouldn't be running those ads if they weren't a little bit worried. And what they're in touch with is that on the ground, out there in America, people aren't really thrilled about coal-fired power plants. They're not really thrilled about, strip mining and, destroying mountains in order to turn on a light, and they think maybe there's a better way. So, the public support is out there. What's really lacking sometimes is just a feeling that it's worth the effort, because there's this sense that you know, whatever big business wants, big business gets. Well, we actually have a situation where there's a new big business emerging. There were more people building wind farms last year than there were mining coal. So now there's a little bit more of a contest over what's going to be the future of our energy system. The other thing I just want to say is that I think the climate movement, the environmental movement, has done a little bit of a disservice in that they've focused so much on people's lifestyle changes. You get this impression that we're not going to solve the problem until every single one of us puts on a hair shirt and becomes, you know, lives in a cave. Mm-hmm. And that's not going to happen. I mean, we have to deal with the world as it is. And maybe 5 or 10% of people will really be sort of virtuous, you know, energy users. But you have to deal with people as they are. So you have to be strategic, and you have to look at the energy system, and you have to figure out what's the worst part of it, what's the part that we can really deal with it. And then you have to ask yourself, is that going to be enough to actually deal with the climate problem? Well, you know, ultimately, maybe Homo sapiens is, you know, our very existence is incompatible with the survival of planet Earth. But right now, the facts don't really say that. That's sort of a leap of despair. So, you know, really, this whole talk about coal and about citizen action isn't really about hope or faith or anything. It's just a pragmatic attempt to deal with the climate problem.
We're talking with Ten Nace, founder of Coal Swarm and author of Climate Hope on the Front Lines of the Fight Against Coal. You talk about quite a number of instances, case studies, one could say, about how this movement was able to move forward and move forward so swiftly. Tell us about Kansas and Kathleen Sebelius.
Oh, can I just interject one story before that?
Oh, yeah.
Which is really interesting to me, which is about the investor Warren Buffett. And Buffett, you know, he's sort of considered the epitome of mainstream establishment thinking on so many things. You know, he's a very successful businessman, and I think other business people take their direction from him. And Buffett was going to build 6 or 7 coal plants in over about a year and a half's time when, you know, he became the target of activism and a lot of these tactics. He dropped all his coal plants, and he did it really on economic grounds. But anyway, yeah, to move on to Kansas, this is a really interesting example because to pair it up with Florida, now there's two states that you wouldn't exactly you know, say are the most liberal states, especially Kansas. Kansas happened to have a Democratic governor, and Florida had a Republican governor during this period when so many coal plants were on the drawing boards. And, you know, really one of the most courageous politicians, I think, out there was Kathleen Sebelius, who's now the Secretary of Health and Human Services. At the time, she was the governor of Kansas, and she vetoed the coal plant on climate grounds, which was a first. And she also stood up to her state legislature, which was largely in the pocket of the utilities. And, you know, she didn't start off opposing coal. She was, you know, she was pushed into that place by, you know, grassroots activism. But she definitely lived up to the challenge. And Charlie Crist in Florida, a Republican governor, his state was becoming very interested in climate change because being hit by hurricane after hurricane after hurricane and starting to see this really costs money. You know, and if this is what climate change means, if it means more, you know, more intense storms, if it means more frequent storms, you know, they didn't want to have anything to do with it. So he sort of led the way, and he sent his assistants, you know, some of his staff, to meet with each of the utilities, and they just said, "Look, you've got to stop building coal plants," and they canceled quite a few. So you know, it just goes to show that regular mainstream politicians can be part of this too.
And then there's the grandmother's rebellion. What's that?
Well, that's a really great example of, you know, really grassroots activity. This was a case that happened in New Mexico on the Navajo Reservation in 2006. A woman named Eloise Brown, who lived on the reservation, you know, was an activist. She was driving out in her truck one day, and she saw a contractor go onto the land of a grandmother in her 80s named Alice Gilmore. So Eloise blocked the contractor with her pickup truck. You know, this surveying truck was blocked by a pickup truck. And then she got on her cell phone and she called Gilmore, and Gilmore called all kinds of family members, and they just set up a little camp right there in the road, you know, put up a tent. The grandmother sat around an oil drum trying to keep warm. You know, they got into sub-zero weather. More and more people came. It became sort of a cause celeb on YouTube. people were writing about it all around the country. And, you know, it's just that kind of spontaneous community action that can make all the difference. I mean, that plant that they were opposing has still not been built. It looks like it won't be built. Those kind of stories, you know, when you read about them, you just marvel over, you know, what ordinary people are capable of.
Now, I want to ask you a question about shutting down the coal industry, and that is a question about jobs. What is the position of the United Mine Workers, and what are we going to do? You know, we're going through a terrible situation of joblessness in this country. How do you answer people who say, what about the workers?
Well, I think you have to start with the needs of the workers, or you don't have an issue that's going to fly. You know, unfortunately, coal is no longer really a union business. When they took the coal industry and moved so much of it to the West Coast and automated so much of it, and they closed down so many of the underground mines and replaced it with surface mining, they replaced tens of thousands, even hundreds of thousands of workers with giant machines. So the people who operate those machines right now, there's about 75,000 people in mining. Those people, you know, have good working class jobs that should be guaranteed and should be able to be guaranteed in any kind of energy transition. I mean, you need the same level of work, if not more, to have wind farms, to insulate houses, to build solar plants, as you do to run, you know, giant strip mines with huge machinery. So the promise of an energy transition is a promise that there be more jobs. Now, the big kind of critical question is, will the jobs be located in the same place as the displaced workers are located? Now, there's two answers to that. One is that if you're going to shut down 600 large coal plants in the United States, you don't just go out and turn a key and turn them all off. You have to have something that's planned over a period of decades. The workforces in those plants are generally in their early 50s on average, so just normal attrition of the workforce should mean that no one actually would have to be laid off. A lot of times there's two or three generating units at one site. One would have been built in the early 60s, one in the, say, early 70s, one in the late 70s or early 80s. So as the whole complex shrinks, as that utility, you know, becomes greener, those people, as they retire, you know, the remaining workforce can work in the remaining plants. You still have to think about the community that relies on the economic activity from that plant. And I think we have a really good model in the way we've shut down military bases. There's a system called BRAC, the Base Realignment and Closure Process. And what BRAC does is it looks at the whole community, involves the whole community in the economic transition that happens when a military base is shut down. And just by the way, the fact that they've been able to shut down 350 military bases, that shows that it is possible to take on these sort of pork barrel government, you know, or big utility centers of economic activity in local areas, you know, that are so strongly defended by local politicians. It's possible to take those on and change them, and it's also possible to meet the needs of those communities. So, yeah, the answer is it can be done, but it's not something that should be done by rolling over the workers. And I think if the environmental movement takes that approach, they're really going to find themselves on the wrong side of public opinion.
Right. Ted Nace, your wonderful book, and it's also a very fascinating book to read. It's called Climate Hope on the Front Lines of the Fight Against Coal. Thanks so much for coming on to the show today.
Thanks so much for having me.
That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net for more about today's shows. You'll find links to more information, web-only features, and you can sign up for our podcast and get connected on Twitter and Facebook. Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.